Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you only by The Nation Magazine. I'm Dave Zirin, thrilled to welcome a legend onto the show. And for fans of his, a legend for reasons beyond their knowledge. He was one half of the most impactful hip-hop radio show ever. Not an exaggeration, Stretch and Bobbito on WKCR. And he, along with his co-host Stretch Armstrong, were inducted at long last, overdue, in the NAB Hall of Fame, the Radio Hall of Fame in 2023. But that's not all. Not even close. Trailblazer, filmmaker, professional hoopster, famed sneaker designer. And if I went all in on this intro, we would have no time for the interview. Now, for this interview, though, we're talking hoops, particularly his new book, Bobbito's Book of B-Ball Bong Bong, memoir of sports, style, and soul.
Ooh, you gave the subtitle, too? You're like a real publisher, bro.
It's too good a subtitle. His fans call him Bobbito, a.k.a. Cool Bob Love. I may be a fan, but I just call him Bob.
Aww.
His name is Bobbito Garcia. How are you doing, Bob? How are you, sir?
That was the most incredible intro while a host is laying down. I don't know how you were able to be so energized in the position that you're in.
Bob is calling me out for my bad neck. I am in a particular half-prone position, but I'm so pumped up to do this interview.
I'm
6 feet above the ground. So, Bob, what an incredible book. Bobbito's Book of B-Ball Bong Bong. Above all else, this is your hoops memoir, although I do believe it is more than that. Just to start, why did you decide? You always have a ton of projects brewing. Why did you decide to take the time to do this book? And please explain the title as well.
Well, when I was writing my first title, Where'd You Get Those? New York City Sneaker Culture, 1960 to 1987, which documented exactly what the title suggests. But at the same time, it was completely autobiographical in that it was my journey, my experiences in that space, along with my friends and my community. And it had like a sort of a group chat vibe to it that was like transcribed but doctored heavily. And then while I was writing that, I was having so much fun with the process that I started writing a memoir back then in 2002 2003. I just got sideswiped by 2003. The book came out. That's the same year I did NBA Street Volume 2, the video game. I was the announcer for it. I was doing Nike commercials. I just came off doing Nike Freestyle. I was touring, doing halftime shows. I was DJing. I was hosting events. I was producing events. I started a magazine in 2003 called Bounce from the Playground, first publication dedicated to outdoor basketball year round. I mean, I was just doing way too much, just doing way too much, Dave. And the memoirs just sort of like took a sidestep. You know, the sneaker book did well. You know, it's still in print, you know, seventh or eighth edition, 10th anniversary, 20th anniversary edition. So I just kind of moved on and kept, you know, I started making films. My first documentary, Doing It in the Park, Pickup Basketball NYC, co-produced with Kevin Coolio. You were on camera for us.
Let's move that. Let's move on from on camera.
But I
You're
mean, essentially,
talking.
you know, it took about 20 years to get back to the idea of writing a memoir. And I went kind of as often as I do, I didn't follow the script, right? Most people write a memoir and then, you know, get an option for it to be developed into a documentary or a feature film. I actually, you know, I did a reverse pivot. I did a autobiographical documentary first titled Rock Rubber 45s in 2018. New York Times critics pick, you know, Smithsonian, National Museum of African American History and Culture, first film festival official selection, you know, blah 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 blah. And that was sort of the blueprint for what would become Bobito's Book of B-Ball Bong Bong. So I just did it opposite. And I'm glad I did, you know, because I think there are things that I can do and filmmakers can that an author never can achieve. And at the same time, I can write in a manner that no filmmaker can ever wish to expand upon. So, you know, here we are with a memoir that I started in 2023. You know, I wrote it in 7 months. The title originally was Book of B-Ball Bong Bong because it was originally going to be a collection of my poetry related to the sport, my contributions to various publications, including Slam, which we both have written for, Beatdown, which was originally co-founded by Sasha Jenkins, who we just lost this week, amazing human being. I wrote for a number of magazines in the 90s, Source Magazine, eventually Vibe. And so those were outlets for my expression as a b-ball sort of like aficionado, you know, player, historian. But you know, in the first draft of Bong Bong, I quickly realized that, you know, creating a hodgepodge of, you know, articles that never were published or some that were, you know, but the raw versions of them would be cool, but it was like cheating myself. And so I went back to the memoir that I started in 2003. And I started picking and piecing together all the articles that I've written, and I created my first draft. And that was, I think, May 6th. It was literally like 2 years ago to the month of this recording. And then from there, I just started expanding, creating connective tissue. You know, I never wrote a memoir before, so I was like looking up online, like how many, you know, words should each chapter be, what should be the total word count, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's just really carving out this space with a huge learning curve. I'm a storyteller. You know, I mean, Nike's hired me to do that. Wieden & Kennedy, the ad agency, you know, I mean, I can go on and on. I've been booked to do speaking engagements from, you know, Brown University, all the way down to Seoul DXB in Dubai. I've been storytelling for a long time. That comes to me really naturally and you know, and thankfully, you know. So I just try to pour that sort of, you know, narrative expression into a memoir that was both historical for my life, but at the same time doubled as sort of this blueprint of what's happened in playground basketball from the 60s to the present, which is not, it's not easy to do that, you know, but because I'm so embedded in the culture, you know, it's like while I'm saying, I'm not saying I am the culture, but what I'm saying is that I've been on the mic, I've been playing, I've played with and against legends, I've watched legends, I've announced legends, I've consulted, you know, brands, agencies, I've traveled the world, you know, giving clinics. So I just sort of like took all that and pieced it together to create a b-ball memoir. And then at that point, I just kept it as Babito's Book of B-Ball Bong Bong, because it was, even though it was no longer a collection of poetry and articles, it still was a collection of experiences. And yeah, I think, you know, the cover was
beautiful cover.
Thank you. It was highly curated. I, you know, not only did I put my hand embellishments on it, on the photo, kind of like a mashup inspired by Jeanette Beckman's book of the same title, as well as Jose Parla and JR's trip to Cuba over 10 years ago, where they did, you know, sanctioned full building murals, you know, with people's faces who were not like political figures. You know, the main thing with the cover was that not only was the title playful, but I wanted the photo of me to be amusing. So, you know, I looked at a lot of covers for basketball memoirs, and they're mostly about NBA players or former ones. Mm. And that's beautiful. But I wanted to smile. I wanted to people to see that, you know, the asphalt is not, you know, all trash talk and, you know, getting beat up and all this other stuff. Like, there's a joy to it as well. And I think, you know, the memoir speaks to that in a very like spiritual manner.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because it's very difficult to extricate your memoir from the New York City street ball scene. What do you think it was particularly about New York's basketball scene that inspired you to want to make basketball a part of your life forever? And do you think that happens if, say, you are in another city? Like, was it the game itself, or was it what New York did to the game?
I think it's all of that. I think, you know, I played tennis as a 14, 15 year old. It was fun. You know, I played Little League baseball. I mean, I wrote about that in my first chapter, how I played, you know, two hand touch football, you know, tag, you know, all these sort of like playground schoolyard games that we grew up with. I played baseball, Little League. I mean, all those things were cool. You know, they were fun in the moment. But when basketball really arrived as like the forefront of what my life is going to become, all that other stuff became irrelevant and you know, unimportant. You know, people would talk to me about the NFL in recent years, and I'm like, yo, the last time I followed the NFL, Brad Van Pelt and Harry Carson and Lawrence Taylor were the linebackers for the Giants. And you know, for people who know who they were, they're like, yo, like, what? Those are the last three players I remember their name and, you know, knew their numbers, whatever. Like, once I got into basketball, it was like nothing else mattered. I didn't have a girlfriend until like, what, like 1990. I was like 25 years old when I had my first girlfriend. Like, my whole youth was dedicated to becoming the best ball player that I could possibly be. And even now, where I don't live in the five boroughs, that flame is still inside me to become the best ball player I can possibly be. And so I search for new courts, and I search for, for new ways to dribble and new ways to express myself with, you know, ball handling. And, you know, I'm still working on my left-hand jump shot. Like, you know, this is a lifetime commitment. This is not just like, oh, I played, you know, pro ball and now I'm, you know, now I'm playing pickleball. Like, nah, F that. You know, like, I mean, no knock on other sports, you know, but New York sort of infuses one with a sort of like unavoidable passion. Like, you can't walk the streets and not pass by a court. You know, you can't walk into a school or a college and not pass by the gym, you know? And it just overtook me. It just overtook me, Dave. And the city has so much history. You know, we have the longest running. I mean, we have the very first summer ball tournament for youth is started in New York, in Harlem, to be specific. Shout out to Mr. Holcomb Rucker. You know, I mean, that's, you think about that, you know, how huge, huge NBA Summer League is, you know, like FIBA 3-on-3, like all these outdoor, well, actually NBA Summer League's not outdoors, but, you know, any, you know, we think about all the activity that goes on outdoors. And like, there was one man in Harlem in 1946 who said, you know what, I'm going to grab my whistle. I'm going to take a score sheet out of my back pocket and I'm going to use my watch to keep time. That's what he was. Holcomb Rucker was a one man show, like literally. And so, you know, I am part of that legacy. You're part of that legacy. Anybody who plays basketball in New York or who visits for that matter is part of that legacy. And it's thick, you know, and it's, look at, you know, Chicago has great history, Philadelphia, you know, Boston, you know, we're not alone. You know, by any stretch of the imagination, you know, I played in 47, 48 countries. I mean, basketball is thick in China, thick in Hong Kong. And, you know, my tournament, FC 21 All World, I've done it. I do it in 30 international locations every summer, but I've done it at this point in like maybe 40, 45 cities. You know, so it's like, it's.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No. It's just, you know, I'll keep talking. Cut me off.
All right, I'm going to cut you off. You'd be a good person to ask this, you know, one of the, maybe the perfect person to ask this, like one of the complaints about soccer is on a global scale is that there used to be much stronger national or regional differences country to country. And part of the fun was watching these different styles clash. One of the complaints is that recent years, because of everything from global coaching to analytics to players not staying in their country, is that there's been a flattening of the style where you could play, you never used to be able to say, well, I'll play in Brazil or I'll play in Germany and it'll be very similar. Now you can say that. What do you see? What have you seen? Actually, let's make it an evolution question from when you started to right now. As far as how basketball has it become flattened culturally? I mean, another way to put it is, has New York just gone global and now we're all New York now? And do you feel like you saw that process during the course of your basketball life?
I'm part of the
making it happen.
The advocacy. Yeah. And the evangelizing of that spark. Because I'm born in the 60s. But absolutely, I mean, there was a time in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, you know, where, I mean, all these places that I traveled to, people knew I was from New York immediately by the tournament t-shirt that I had on, by the sneakers that I wore. You know, there was a time where Air Force Ones were only available in Baltimore or Philly and New York, right? So, you know, the first time I landed in Puerto Rico to play pro ball, you know, my teammate who I was meeting for the first time, you know, I'm only 5'9", 5'10". There's no, it's not like I'm 6'8" and it's clear that I'm a ball player. He spots me in the baggage claim because I had on Air Force Ones. And I was like, yeah, how did you know who I was? And he was like, cause you're the only dude at the airport with Air Force Ones on. You had to be a ball player.
That's so,
No, and it's a true story, you know, and it's mentioned, that's mentioned in the book.
Yes.
But, you know, as New York City starts getting documented and as it starts getting proliferated in advertising, and in film and in movies, you know, I mean, Hollywood didn't really do a great job of positioning what the essence of New York City basketball is about. You know, didn't do a great job. It did okay, fine. But, you know, there's some instances where people,
Any particular movie examples come to mind that actually get it right?
For New York,
It's tough.
I mean, it's tough. It's tough because I have issue with every basketball scripted basketball film about that takes place in New York ever made, right? So I mean, there's some stuff that's okay. I mean, I wasn't above the rim, you know, but I thought
felt very LA to me.
I mean, yeah, it's like, you know, the shirts that the players are wearing when you're shooting around and playing pickle, like nobody. I mean, yeah, some people iron their shirt, but like it's clearly there's a wardrobe person who went to the store and bought like store-bought, like, you know, gear for the players to wear. It's like, get out of here. You know, like when people showed up to the park, they just got a white t-shirt on and some fly-ass tournament shorts. That's the culture, you know, and more than likely not ironed, you know. So it's like little stuff like that, you know. Hollywood always plays up the argument and the trash talk, which absolutely exists, but it's like a minute part of the game outdoors. You know, I mean, on and on. Anyway, the point is that
what does He Got Game get right and get wrong?
He Got Game was too polished as well. You know, I mean, it has some great moments, you know, has some great moments. Ray Allen to me doesn't look like a New York ball player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he as amazing of a ball athlete and skilled ball player that he is, Ray Allen doesn't come off to me as a, he doesn't even have that New York sort of walk, you know? So to me, from jump, him being in the lead, it doesn't, that's not New York. Like his posture is almost too good. You know, I mean, credit to him as a human being, you know, for the student athlete that he was. But yeah, I mean, Ray doesn't have that New York sort of, you know, vocab, natural, like where it's believable that he's from Brooklyn at that, you know?
Kind of had to be a point guard too, as the protagonist. I thought it was a little odd having it be a wing.
Yeah. I mean, but he had a handle, you know, I mean, you know, look, He Got Game had some things that, but again, it, you know, and Spike, you know, the court, when they shot the court, they made it look too beautiful, you know, at night when they had the garden, you know, it's lit too well, you know, and I get it. It's Hollywood, you know, and it's Spike who was, you know, a master at doing contrast and, you know, color correction and all that. But there's some moments when He Got Game that just lost me. And same thing with, you know, when I watched Hoosiers, for example, like I was completely in, like they got everything right. Hustle, Adam Sandler recently, it's not a New York film, but they got everything right. Like the nuance, the ethos. It's like, ah, yes, I'm on the court with you, you know? Anyway, all that said, you know, there were some, you know, and that's why the And1 mixtape and the early Nike City Attack campaign commercials that I was a part of, you know, that's why they hit so hard, because they were raw. Mm-hmm. It was like, now we're seeing New York the way it's meant to be seen, without the filters, without the lighting, without the wardrobe, the hair, makeup, and all this other extraneous stuff that makes it look all too polished. The courts in our city are not that polished, mm-hmm. you know? They should have put trash at the garden, you know, and He Got Game to make it look authentic. Put some broken glass, you know, down. It's like, you know, the park was too clean. You know, it's like nobody left their t-shirt behind on the fence. That's a given. You go to a park, you know what I'm saying? Somebody left their ball deflated and somebody left their sneakers hanging on and somebody left their t-shirt. You know, it's like it was too manicured. No knock on Spike. I love him. You know what I'm saying? But anyway, but yeah, as these sort of ex as the game starts getting exposed out of New York, it certainly puts an effect on the proliferation and the ascension of how the game is played our way globally. I still think that New York is distinct and unique. But certainly, you know, I mean, again, I wrote this in Bobito's book of B-Boy Bong Bong. Yeah, I've been in South Africa, I've been in Japan, where until you hear the person speak, there's no way you know that they're not from New York. They
Wow.
the gear that they got on, the way they their haircut, you know, they've watched the music videos, they've watched the mixtapes. They studied, they haven't just watched them, they studied them, you know, and so.
Well, what makes your book so interesting is that you were playing before in a highly competitive level before this kind of globalization of the sport or even nationalization in the United States of a very similar way of playing place to place. And I found that part of the book maybe the most fascinating. You were taking the city game into a more countrified or university atmosphere. What was the toughest adjustment in coming up the way you played? And all of a sudden, playing with a bunch of folks who are coming at this from a totally different context. Coaches is.
I think, the turning point in the book is I finally finished playing college basketball at Western University, and then I'm back in New York, and it's like, you know, I feel like like, you know, I'm no longer contained. You know, I'm back in New York, and people love when I do a trick or a fancy pass. They embrace, they encourage me, you know, to play the way that I want to play, you know. And that's not a knock against coaches who are trying to create a team concept. And you know, I mean, I think people often get confused that when they think of like people who play on the asphalt, that they're very individual, my individual minded. And you know, like there's a ton of people who are phenomenal passers who are great leaders on the floor that play outdoors. You know, it's not just like every, you know, I think the stereotype is that the person is a nut and only about themselves and, you know, wants to go one-on-one every play. I mean, sure, that happens, but that happens in the coaching context too. Certain players get a green light, and then every time they touch the ball, it's not going back out, you know? So, you know, I think I was grateful that I learned how to play in an organized context and in the completely unabashed, unleashed context as well. You know, the beauty to me of playing pickup is that you have no coaches, you have no subs, there's no plays, and there's no guarantee when you show up to the park that you know anybody or seen any of them play before. So we're talking about simultaneous creation, right? You're trying to figure out how to score with four other players or two other players. Or if you're playing 21 against five to six, seven defenders, right? In the moment, there's no pre-context. There's no preparation. I mean, there's preparation that you work on your fundamentals and you learn pick and roll and you learn how to play defense, you know, in organized context. And then you take those elements in the in an open context and pick up. And I think it's like understated how beautiful that is.
No doubt.
Yeah, but I definitely felt like unleashed once I came back to New York, and particularly because I was living uptown, you know, so it was like that's heaven. You know, that's heaven.
Heaven is a playground.
That's right. Shout out to Rick Tellender who purchased my book. Shout out to Alex Wolf as well, who purchased my memoir. Those are two writers that really inspired me in my youth to even become a writer. And if you're not familiar with Alex Wolf, he authored the In Your Face basketball book, as well as Big Game, Small World, two of my favorites. with In Your Face probably being my favorite basketball book ever.
Myself.
Ever. And then Heaven is a Playground. It's just unreal. Shout out to Rick Talender, who's become a dear friend. I mean, you know, he's incredible. When my son was born, you know, he sent a stool for him to sit on that he like handmade and painted. It was like, yo, Rick, what are you doing? Such a beautiful, beautiful dude. Shout out to Pete Axelm too, who's kind of like the grandfather of all of us, who wrote The City Game in 1970, I believe. Prior to that, I'm not really aware of a book about outdoor basketball that existed prior to Pete. So Pete, rest in peace.
And also one that rooted the game so squarely in New York City.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That book is so important as a kind of tentpole, a marker. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Of let's, you know, no matter how big this gets, let's never get it twisted.
Yeah.
That, you know, Springfield, Massachusetts is invented how we play basketball.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Where it comes from. You've been so generous with your time, but I'd be remiss, and my listeners would get on me if I didn't ask you about hip hop and how this connects to everything we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
How integrated was hip hop for you in your basketball life? Did you see these things as separate spheres that would only connect maybe if someone brought a boombox to the court? Or did you see them aesthetically as walking hand in hand?
Yeah, I often get asked this question, and I have to say, like, they are separate spheres, but are highly interconnected, location-wise, spiritually, in terms of the ethos of both being so competitive and so creative. There's a lot of parallels. But they are complete, you know, when people are like, oh, you know, basketball is another element of hip hop. Like, no, it's not. Basketball existed for 80 years before hip hop came around, you know. And that's, you know, and I don't like it when people just add on to hip hop. It's like hip hop is this movement that was really mind blowing and had a burgeoning upbringing in the 70s, you know, with of course elements from the 50s, 60s, 40s, even before that, that lead up to it. But what we know and what we term as hip hop is hip hop, right? And, you know, it's grown, it's evolved, but you know, when Iverson was playing in the NBA and people were like, oh yeah, hip hop and basketball are the same. It's like, no, they're not. That, you know, hip hop has been informed by basketball in many ways. And basketball has been informed by hip hop as well. But I would say lesser, like B-ball has way more influenced hip hop than hip hop has influenced B-ball. You know, there were fancy players before hip hop in the sport. You know, there were players who, you know, would customize their sneakers before hip hop existed. There were players who, you know, were very street, you know, with their, you know, with their disposition and their hairstyle, like, you know.
Hey, Fly Williams, we were just talking about Heaven is a Playground.
I mean, you know, let's think about, you know, all the amazing Afros in the 70s, you know, post the Black Power movement in the 60s, you know, that has nothing to do with hip hop. That has something to do with African-Americans in the United States in the 60s, you know, trying to take claim of their beauty and their hair and sort of negate all the negativity that had been pushed on them for decades about, you know, trying to assimilate. And that's what that is. And sure, and hip hop has that core element as well, you know, but it's a separate era. It's a separate community. And at the same time, it's connected. So.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm trying to relate to your nation listeners with that one. And let me say, I don't know if you know this, Dave, but the Nation was a sponsor for many years of the GOAT tournament on 99th Street in Amsterdam. You know, I think because of the relationship with Professor Steve Cohen, who was a Russian studies professor at Princeton. I think his wife was the editor-in-chief or publisher of Katrina The Nation.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, the legendary both editor and publisher emeritus to this day at The Nation magazine.
Okay, cool. Well, they were related, and I think, and so Professor Steve Cohen was like, yo, like sponsor the GOAT, because Earl Manigault and Stephen Cohen were very tight friends.
Amazing.
You know, and Steve gets mentioned in the book.
Yeah.
But The Nation, you know, I would go to 99th Street in Amsterdam to either play in the tournament or watch the tournament, because, you know, it had different age groups. And on the back of the t-shirt was The Nation before I even knew what The Nation was. So that's kind of cool. That's kind of, and I'm going to try to find, I have three GOAT tournament t-shirts still. All-star t-shirt in 99, which was big for me, because Earl had passed away the year before. And I think The Nation logo is on the back, but I'll check. I'll send you a picture. So
keep all your shirts.
For some reason, my tournament shirts are Citywide, Holcomb Ruckum Memorial, RYA, Upward Fund, all those shirts from the 80s. I don't know what happened to them. Maybe in between the moves, but all my shirts from the 90s and on, I still have. Yeah.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, again, I would be remiss if I let you go without asking you about New York Knicks. I mean, when this airs, it's possible the series will be over, or it's possible we'll be gearing up for a game 7. Pacers, Knicks, chance to go to the finals. Does this Knicks team, you know, we're hearing all the time about capturing the heart of the city.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, when they say that, they often just, you know, turn the camera to Ben Stiller and Timothy Chalamet. That's the heart of the city. But obviously, I was raised there. All my people are, you know, like their eyes are just dazed at how far we've come. Also, fear about losing the opportunity to beat a very gettable, in my opinion, Indiana Pacers team.
Yeah.
All know what happened game 1. So the Knicks, what do you think of this team? And do you feel like they're as special to the city as the media keeps telling us?
That's a tough question, because I haven't followed the Knicks in a very long time. And, you know, my book opens up with a throw to my father, who was a huge fan. Mm-hmm. And the very first line of the book is, you know, it's talking about my relationship with my father, who wants to watch the NBA on TV. And I want to, you know, I want to enjoy happy days and welcome back Cotter. But I haven't followed the Knicks in a very long time. I haven't been a fan or a spectator of the NBA in a very long time. I've done work for the franchise. I've done work for the league. I've been in an association with the NBPA. I was a trainer back in 2020 for them, virtually and remotely.
The pro game doesn't grab you.
I mean, listen, I love seeing highlights. I love knowing that the Knicks are doing well. I don't lose any sleep when they lose. I can't tell you who the leading assist or steals leader has been in 30, 35 years. You know, this Knicks team right now, the reason why I get excited about them winning is because the further they go, the more people get inspired to play basketball outdoors.
Well, that's true.
And that's flat out, to me, what matters the most. You know, and the NBA as a marketing vehicle is phenomenal, not just for promoting their televised games and their merchandise. It's like they help people around the world want to play the game. Mm-hmm. It's aspirational. And even when you don't, when you realize, like I did when I was 14, I'm never going to play in the NBA, right? But I still can watch players and plays and highlights and games and moments and use that for fuel to go outside and work on my own. And so I think the NBA and the Knicks and, you know, advertisers and the marketing and the publicity, all that, they work in unison with what I do, which is I'm trying to be the evangelist to get people to play outdoors, right? I've been that ambassador for decades now, right? There's a reason why I've been to 47 countries and six continents. You know, there's a reason why I was flown to Auckland, New Zealand to announce a 3-on-3. You know, there's a reason why the State Department brought me to Senegal to visit six cities and teach basketball skills. There's reasons behind this. There's a reason why Nike flew me to Rio de Janeiro to DJ and announce basketball out there. You know, I mean, there's a reason for all this, right? And so I want people to play. And if the Knicks make it to the championship, and that means that that many more people wind up playing this summer and the days and weeks and months leading up afterwards, then I'm all for it. If the Knicks win, I'm all for it for that reason. But as a, you know, as a personally, I couldn't, like, if they lose the next three games, all right, cool. I'm still going out and playing ball. I'm a ball player, not a spectator. And it's, you know, I think that's the misconception of a lot of people, similar to in the sneaker realm. People forever think that I'm a collector. I've never been a collector. I even, if you read my book, I say, like, I'm not a collector. I'm a historian. I love design. I love performance. I came to Kicks because I'm a ball player and I wanted something that was functional, that was going to help my ankles not twist and my knees lat. So, you know, so people often think of me in the ways that I really don't want to project.
No,
you know?
I got you. And, you know, one of the great things about the book is that it's got the love for the outdoor game in a way that I also think, you know, maybe more than the Knicks, is going to inspire people to go outdoors and play ball, because that's what it's all about. Because I never felt better about Cooper Flagg, who's the next NBA phenom coming out of Duke, 18 years old, white dude from Maine. He was at Rucker a couple weeks back and hit the winning shot. And to see everybody mob him, for him to look like he belonged.
Yeah.
Through the poise and through the skills of his game, and people apparently love playing with him because he's pass first, sick defense. But my goodness, man, like at that moment, it's like you almost see in our deeply divided society the promise of the outdoor game to bring people together. And that is unique about the outdoor game that I have found compared to doing run indoors, is the way it brings people together, the way it creates relationships.
Absolutely.
It's about being outdoors and doing it. There's nothing like it.
Absolutely. Listen, I mean, you know, you want to go to the Garden and watch the Knicks, you got to pay a hefty price.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you want to watch 30 games a week, you got to pay, you know, the league pass, you know, or you got to have, you pay for ESPN Plus, and, you know, you got to pay for this, you got to pay for that. You know, you can see Instagram highlights, YouTube highlights for free, you know, but then you probably got to watch ads and, you know, be bombarded. You know, you go to the park to play, or if you want to go to the park to watch, yeah, that's free. You don't have to be a student. You have to have, you don't have to have an ID. You don't have to be a member of the Reebok Club. Like, you know, all these sort of things that make the game exclusive, which is beautiful. I mean, you know, there's space for that as well. You know, some people don't want to see somebody who's unhoused, you know, asking them for money, you know, while they're shooting around with their 5-year-old. You know, I get that, you know, but that's not my lane, you know.
Yeah. And you gotta, if you're gonna play the city game, you have to confront the city. You can't pretend it's this hermetically sealed, sellable brand product.
Right. Right. And that's, you know, I say all the time, like, listen, I, you know, I present the playground atmosphere in a very beautiful, sort of lavish way, but that's, you know, it's not perfect. You know, I mean, and that's why I love it too. You know, that's why it's so dear to me, because it has its edge, you know, and to me, I've always leaned counterculture.
Yeah. And this book is that all the way and 10 times on Sunday.
Thank you.
Yo, Bobito, thank you so much, my man. I mean, I know you as Bob. The world knows you as Bobito and Cool Bob Love. You're a legend in like five different spheres. But only elevates you, in my mind, in one of those pre-existing spheres, and that's the written word. Thank you so much for joining us here.
No doubt. All right, my brother, be safe, man.
Yeah, for everybody out there listening, please hold on because we have a word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there. This is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it, but we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. Ooh, thank you so much, The Nation. I want to really thank our guests this week, Bobito, aka Cool Bob Love, aka Bob Garcia. An absolute honor to have the hip hop and basketball legend on the show. Everybody's got to check out his memoir, Basketball Bong Bong. It is too good. Thank you so much to the producer of this podcast, David Tigaboo. Thank you so much to The Nation. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.